America Looks Abroad, presented at this hour on Sunday afternoon by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, which is open to all who are interested in American foreign policy, offers accurate information on current world events. In the light of Friday's peace moves, Mrs. Vera Michelis Dean, FPA authority on European affairs, will speak today in place of Mr. Howard J. Trueblood, Latin American expert originally scheduled for this time. Mrs. Dean's subject will be, Is Europe Ready for Roosevelt Peace Moves? Mrs. Dean.
Good afternoon. All the events of the past week are overshadowed by the news that President Roosevelt has launched his long-expected peace offensive. This peace offensive is being launched on three fronts. First, Mr. Sumner Wells, Undersecretary of State, is to sail next Saturday for Italy to gather information on conditions in Italy, Germany, France, and Britain. Second, Mr. Myron Taylor, who at Christmas had been appointed personal representative of the President to the Pope, is sailing on the same boat for his mission to the Vatican. And third, according to a statement made by Secretary Hull on Friday, negotiations are already in progress with European neutrals, whose object is to achieve a sound and lasting peace for all nations, restoration of a sound international economic system, and worldwide reduction in armaments. This peace offensive comes at a decisive moment in the European conflict. Germany and their allies are deadlocked on the Western Front. The Soviet Union has launched a new and determined attack on the Mannerheim Line and claims to have captured 13 forts, a claim vigorously denied by the Finns. In the Near East, their allies, with the help of Turkey, are preparing for a possible drive either against Germany or Russia. It had long been expected in Washington that this spring, possibly as early as March, either the Allies or Germany or both would attempt to end the present stalemate by undertaking large-scale operations. Europe might then experience the kind of totalitarian war which it has so far been spared in the West, and the prospect of a negotiated peace would then be reduced to the vanishing point. For this reason, it has seemed to the President and to some of his advisers that the United States, as the most powerful neutral in the world, should take advantage of this breathing spell to sound out the belligerents regarding the possibility of a negotiated peace. President Roosevelt's move, whatever its ultimate success, is not inspired solely by the altruistic desire of seeing war brought to an end in Europe. As the war goes on, the United States, like other neutral countries, is beginning to realize the high cost of neutrality. Obviously, we are free from the anxieties suffered today by the Scandinavian countries, Holland, Belgium, and the Balkans. Free also from the military and economic burdens we would have to bear if we were actually at war. But in an effort to avoid incidents which might involve us in the European conflict, we have voluntarily surrendered many of our rights as an independent nation, notably the right to have our ships and citizens travel freely on the high seas. Our foreign trade has been disrupted by war, and the Allies who are barred from obtaining loans here are placing orders in this country only for goods they cannot buy elsewhere, such as airplanes and tools, so that the war boom anticipated by some Americans has failed to materialize. The United States also finds it increasingly hard to remain emotionally aloof from the European struggle. There is a saying that military strategists are always getting ready for the last war. We too have been getting ready for the last war by constantly worrying that British and French propaganda might again persuade us to join the Allies against Germany. Our neutrality legislation was designed to safeguard us against repetition of the events of 1914-1917. Yet today, the American public is indignant, not about the wrongs inflicted by Germany on their Allies, about the wrongs inflicted by the Soviet Union on Finland. Now, no one in Congress had probably even thought of the possibility of a Soviet war on Finland when the Neutrality Act was being considered. Yet, if the United States should conceivably be drawn into the European war today, it will not be because of our sympathies for the French and British, who did not pay their debt, but because of our sympathy for Finland, which did pay its debt. Our desire to help the Finns is due in large part to genuine sympathy for them, but in many cases also to fear of communism and hatred of Moscow. The fact must also be faced that the Allies would not be displeased to have us help Finland with armaments. Speaking to the American Youth Congress yesterday, President Roosevelt denounced the Soviet Union as a dictatorship. He declared that 98% of the American people sympathized with Finland and said it was twaddle to think that American assistance to the Finns would involve us in war with Russia. But our dilemma in the case of Finland shows that the longer the war goes on, the more likely it is that the United States will become aroused over incidents we had not foreseen when our neutrality legislation was passed. It is therefore in the interest of the United States that the war should be brought to a close as soon as possible, and it would greatly increase President Roosevelt's prestige in this election year if he should successfully perform the role of peacemaker. It is also in the interest of the United States that the war should be brought to a close by a peace which would neither be a peace of utter exhaustion nor a peace of revenge. A peace of exhaustion would only further deplete Europe's economic resources and open the way to social upheavals, which could hardly contribute to restoration of a sound international economic system. A peace of revenge, whether imposed by the Allies or by Germany, would merely perpetuate existing hatred. It would force the victor to remain fully armed in order to hold down the vanquished, and this would hardly pave the way for reduction of armaments. The only hope for a peace inspired by reason, not by force, is that the belligerents should find a workable compromise before the war has reached more disastrous proportions. But on what basis could peace be negotiated in Europe today? Even more important, should peace be discussed at all at this moment, or will peace negotiations merely improve Germany's striking position in the future? A majority of the French and British remain determined to continue the war until Hitlerism, not merely Hitler, has been crushed. I say a majority because there are still elements in France and Britain, as well as in the neutral countries, who support the policy of appeasement, and who think that if only Hitler were removed by some magic, a peace settlement could be arranged with other Nazis, for example, Goering. Such a pro-appeasement group is active in France. Yet, in spite of its activities, the Chamber of Deputies, at the close of a secret session regarding the conduct of the war, gave a unanimous vote of confidence to Monsieur Daladier yesterday. If this vote is an indication of French public opinion, then it would appear that France is not ready at this moment for another Munich. To understand this mood, you must remember that the French and British had come to the conclusion last September that the kind of peace Europe had known during the 6 years of Hitler's rule was even more nerve-wracking than war. They emphatically do not want to go back to that kind of peace, and they suspect that even if Hitler should resign and devote himself to painting, as he told the British ambassador last summer he would like to do, the evils of Nazism would remain and would continue to plague Europe. They want to destroy these evils root and branch, even if they have to endure a terrible war to achieve this purpose. The question, of course, is, how can these evils be destroyed? Can Nazism be crushed without also crushing the German people? And if the German people are crushed in the process, what hope is there of reconstructing Europe after the war? To this, the French and British say that Europe will know an even worse fate if the Nazis remain in power, and worst of all, if Germany should prove the victor. So they demand war to the finish, and many of them feel that the United States, by intervening at this time, is playing into Hitler's hands. At the same time, we have to realize that millions of Germans who oppose Hitler on every other ground are reluctant to accept a peace dictated by their allies because they fear that Germany might then be dismembered and humiliated. They believe that Hitler alone can preserve German unity, and the desire to achieve unity has dominated the German people for at least a century. The Nazis, like the Allies, want a fight to the finish to achieve that domination of Europe east of the Rhine, which has long been their first objective. The problem of the Allies, and also of the United States, now that we have launched a peace move, is to find within Germany a group of Germans who could succeed the Nazis if Hitler were overthrown and negotiate a compromise with the Allies. There is still danger that the Allies and the United States might seek to come to terms with the German monarchists and industrialists, men like Fritz Thyssen. These men never believed in democracy or liberty. They helped Hitler to power because they hoped he would crush communism and restore Germany's military prestige. Now they hate him because he has signed a pact with the Soviet Union. Should their allies in the United States lean on these men in their efforts to achieve peace, they might find themselves supporting the forces of reaction in Germany, not the forces which might eventually produce a democratic system. And it is difficult to believe that the French or British or American people really want to support reaction in Germany. It is into this vortex of conflicting forces that Mr. Wells and Mr. Taylor will be plunging next week. We can only hope, for the sake both of Europe and of the United States, that our peace move is not being lightly undertaken, that it will not be made a football of domestic politics, and that the Roosevelt administration, as well as the American people, will be fully aware of the responsibilities it implies. For obviously, by exploring the possibilities of peace in Europe, the United States is departing from the path of strict isolation. It is starting on a course which may necessitate some form of open intervention. When President Wilson, in 1915-16, sent Colonel House, his unofficial advisor, on a similar mission to the belligerent countries, he told France and Britain that if Germany did not accept the peace terms he had in mind, the United States would probably enter the war on their side. No one outside official circles in Washington knows today whether similar hints have been made to the Allies. No one knows what promises are being held out to the Nazis for good behavior. But one lesson drawn from our World War experience should be borne in mind. The intervention of the United States, first in the role of peacemaker, then in that of belligerent, profoundly altered the balance of power in Europe at that time and enabled their allies to win a military victory. This victory might have proved more fruitful if the United States, having shouldered the burdens of war, had remained to shoulder the burdens of peace. By withdrawing from Europe after the Paris Peace Conference, the United States, for the second time in 2 years, again profoundly altered the European balance of power. There is, of course, room for legitimate difference of opinion as to whether this country should or should not have entered the war in 1917. But one thing seems clear. If this country does not intend to bear a share of the responsibility for adjusting the far-reaching problems which precipitated the present conflict, then it would be far better in the long run for Europe if we keep our hands off European affairs. For otherwise, we would again be creating vain illusions and arousing false hopes, only to destroy them as we did in 1919.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to Mrs. Vera Michelis Dean, Director of the Research Department of the Foreign Policy Association, speaking in the series America Looks Abroad. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. If you are interested in knowing the facts behind the headlines, send for a free copy of the weekly bulletin, which is written by the people you hear on this program and carrying an article by Mrs. Dean. Address your letter or postcard to the Foreign Policy Association at number 8 West 40th Street, New York. The Foreign Policy Association, number 8 West 40th Street, New York City. Tune into this station next Sunday at 3:15 Eastern Standard Time to hear another speaker in the series America Looks Abroad. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.